move on to the next section, which is on the maps and gaps. And for this, I'll turn it over to Max Nixon. Max,
yes, can you hear me, Aditi?
Yes.
Okay. So, for everyone who is using the webinar, can you see the screen at this point in time? All right. So, to begin with, for those of you who weren't able to hear me about 5 minutes ago, basically the first part of this presentation is just going to be an overview of some surveys I conducted with the state and federal agencies. There's nothing to really see on the screen. Right now, you should just be seeing a base map with a big disclaimer on the bottom and a picture of the Gulf of Maine and the state of Maine. We'll be using that in about 5 to 10 minutes. We won't be taking up the entire hour today for this section. There's a lot of information that was collected during the interview process, but I'm trying to be concise and summarize everything that I uncovered, and there's a lot of duplication as well. So I guess to begin with, I did conduct a survey over the past month per our conversation at the last task force meeting of relevant state and federal agencies who might be involved in either natural resource information or permitting or leasing on the OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf. And I guess I'll go through each of the surveys very quickly here. It was basically just a quick conversation with members of BOEM, United States Coast Guard, Department of Defense, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Maine Historic Preservation Commission, Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, Department of Marine Resources, my own knowledge of what SPO, State Planning Office, has in Maine, and who am I forgetting here? Department of Energy as well. So it was a broad-ranging conversation. And basically, there wasn't a whole lot of earth-shattering new stuff that we did uncover. There was basically a reaffirmation of what I sort of spoke about at our first task force meeting. Basically, we talked about existing data layers. I sort of rattled off a few existing ones. Most of the federal and state agencies had received the data bibliography for review beforehand. And that was to look at what the state of Maine has in terms of data for both the Maine state waters and for the Outer Continental Shelf. And they were to review that and really identify any gaps that the state may have in its database. And we did uncover a couple. Like I said, nothing earth-shattering, but the discussion was more the interesting thing. The identification of new studies that are currently going on. For instance, there is an electromagnetic field study that's going on. There's several different bird migration studies that are currently being undertaken, and there's also a number of different human use activity studies that are currently being funded by the federal government as well, which is encouraging because there, as we'll go into later, there are significant gaps in those different topics. So I guess everyone should have the screen up right now. If there isn't anyone who can see my screen, please yell. Hearing no yelling, we'll be moving on. So, in order to be as concise as possible, as I mentioned, I sort of divided the types of spatial data that we have into more or less three different categories. You have your geophysical information, you have your your habitat, non-human biological information, and then obviously you have your biological information, your environment information. So I'll just go over that briefly here. What we found, Deirdre Gilbert from the Department of Marine Resources will be stepping in to cover a few human use activity maps that we have come into possession of regarding fisheries. So to begin with, geophysical information. This includes data ranging from surficial composition to bathymetry and wind speed, things that you need for a deep water offshore development. And the decision made, or I just won't really say decision, but the determination by the folks I spoke with is that the existing information that we have, which really consists of some older data called, it's basically a conglomeration of surficial sediment estimates that has been around, has been added to for the last 30 plus years. And it's really sort of the best that we have at this point. There are a lot more geographically specific surficial sediment and benthic composition areas that specific studies have been done. Actually, people have gone out and done grab samples at a specific site for a specific purpose. But when we're talking about the OCS, that hasn't really happened all that much out there. And you know, to this point, there's going to be some sort of micro-siting exercise that goes on at whatever development happens on the OCS. You really have to know what the bottom looks like, what it's made of, in order to make an accurate decision about where a development's going to go. So this is our surficial composition. We also have some fairly decent bathymetry data. Again, oh, the colors? Yeah, sure. You'll see on the left-hand side here, the table of contents, there's sort of a color distribution chart. We have the BR stands for bedrock, CL is clay, CL-ST/SD is clay, dash, I forgot what ST is. You have sand and SD is sand, obviously. And then gravel, sand, clay, silt. That's it, ST is silt. But it basically just, like I said, there's an aggregation of data from the U.S. Geographical Survey, the Maine Geological Survey, some work that the University of Maine has done, and it's just a best estimate of what is out there. And you can make some, you can draw some conclusions about what type of environment is out there. The Nature Conservancy, for instance, has made some conclusions based on this data and other data about what the environment is, what the habitat is like. And that's also available on their North Atlantic Marine Ecoregion Assessment, which we're not going to be presenting today. So moving along, we have bathymetry, which is, you know, I mean, it's depth. Anything, if we're talking about the main PUC RFP, anything greater than 300 feet is really what we're talking about here. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Moving a bit slow. So obviously we have some pretty decent bathymetry data. You can see it loading. There's a lot of different lines. There we go. I'm not sure how well you folks can see that on your computers. It's a little difficult for us to see it on a projection here, but we have a relatively good idea about how deep it is in the Gulf of Maine. Moving along to wind.
The dark areas over 300 feet?
No, the dark areas over 300 feet, 90 meters of depth. So anything seaward of that, basically what you're seeing here is anything really seaward of the 3 nautical mile line. There are a couple of instances where it actually is 300 feet or deeper within state waters, but the overwhelming majority of the 300 feet or deeper is outside, or 90 meters, is outside of the state 3 mile limit.
Could you just point out the 3 mile limit and yes. The OCS boundary?
This is the 3 mile limit right here, this line. This yellow line going up the coast. This is the exclusive economic zone line. This is the EEZ. This is the extent of federal waters. It's also called the Hague line. There was a decision in international court about where that line actually was in relation to Canada. And this area right here is a gray area. It's claimed by both Maine and Canada because of this area right here, which is Machias Seal Island. There's a Canadian Coast Guard presence on that island and has been for quite some time. There's also been a lot of U.S. research done out there. Sufficient? Moving along, get into wind data. NREL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, publishes a wind data layer at both 50 and 90 meters. These are estimates, obviously. We don't have buoys out there that are 90 meters high. This is sort of a wind model that shows what the wind speed, the average annual wind speed would be in a particular area. The consensus in the interviews was that this is also not too critical of a data layer. Anything, you know, once you get past 7 miles out to sea, 7-8 miles, and once you're past the islands where they might interfere with any wind speed, you're in pretty windy waters, class 6, class 7 wind, which, again, I mean, this data layer basically shows anything class 6 or 7 is out past that 3 mile line, which obviously isn't always the case, but again, this is just an estimate, best available information. So, moving on to the next category, we have basically habitat, non-human biological information. And this is avifauna, marine mammals, some benthic habitat information. This is where we begin to get into the, it gets a little less clear than with geophysical information. They're very broad topics. Obviously, the agencies we spoke with are charged with protecting, you know, close to thousands of different types of species and overseeing a number of different types of habitat, many of which is undetermined because of the fact that we don't have accurate benthic composition data or benthic substrate data. Bird migration is one of our critical data layers, after our critical needs, I should say. After a conversation with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife in Maine and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service up here, in addition to conversations that we've had with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement about what we need in terms of data, we know where the birds nest. We have a general idea about how far they travel to feed. It's the migration that will be a critical data layer. Regionally, there isn't one that exists. There is a study that currently is being undertaken by Stantec. There's also been several smaller scale. The University of Maine is doing a study out near Monhegan Island currently. But there isn't anything regionally that shows accurate bird migration patterns with actual species identification. I mean, you can set a radar up and you can look at blips, and it's difficult to tell whether or not those blips are birds or moths. In many cases, you don't even know what type of bird it is. So, one of our biggest gaps, and I'll go over this a little bit later on in the presentation, is this regional migration data set. And BOEM is aware of this, and I believe they are currently undergoing work with a couple of other federal agencies that will hopefully fill in some of the holes that we have here in terms of a new report.
Matt, does that data exist for other states off their coasts?
The question was, does that data exist in other states off their coasts? And I believe in the Mid-Atlantic, there's a professor at the University of, it's either Maryland or, what's that? Or Delaware, I believe that. That's done quite a bit of work, at least in terms of migratory bird routes in the Mid-Atlantic area. But I mean, what would be ultimately useful is doing something up here and then combining that with the Mid-Atlantic routes. I remember during our Ocean Energy Demonstration Sighting Initiative up here, speaking with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I mean, there aren't set bird flyways. I mean, it's not like you have an interstate highway that the birds travel on. I mean, it varies from year to year. Moving along, marine mammals. We have a pretty decent opportunistic data layer of marine mammals. Let me see if I can find it here. There we go. Now this layer is fairly, it's an interesting data layer. It's basically a layer that contains sightings of whales, dating back to the 1800s. Some of them all the way up until current. And you'll notice that there are three large blobs. One of them down near Portland, or excuse me, down near York right here. There's another one near Portland or near Booth Bay right here. There's another one up here by MDI. And this is obviously a lot of data that is up near Canada that there's been a lot of work for traffic alteration schemes because of the whales. But these three areas are prime spots for whale watching. And you'll notice that's why there's a lot of whale sightings there, because that's what they go out to see. There's also been some work, some survey work, going down this area where my pointer is, that shows the whales going in exact zigzag straight lines. That's because they were doing survey work. So there isn't a whole lot of work showing, or at least spatially, that we have, showing whale migration, which is yet another gap that we have. We have great opportunistic sightings. Like I said, there isn't a whole lot of work connecting those opportunistic sightings to migration. You can make some inferences about where they're going, why they're going there, but for the most part, that's another gap that we have that we need to fill. Moving along, we have benthic habitat, and there have been a number of groups ranging from state, academic institutions, NGOs, federal agencies that have taken a stab at benthic habitat. And there are a number of different projections. I showed one earlier that was an estimate by a combination of groups. The Nature Conservancy that I mentioned has several estimates about what the bottom looks like, what types of environment might be out there. There's just a number of, I don't want to say conflicting, and I don't want to say complementing, somewhere in between benthic environment data layers that ultimately what it says is there's going to be have to be some sort of micro-siting done before a project can go in. And I believe I covered that earlier. I won't get into it anymore here. To this point, do we have any questions before we get into consumptive uses?
I have a question. The marine mammal data, can it be divided out seasonally?
Yes.
Thank you.
I have a question. Matt, do your maps include the 10-mile line that the legislation?
Yes. Beth Gagusky's referring to the PUC RFP criterion, which were 10 nautical miles from land, and from the coast and any inhabited island, and within 300 meters of water or greater. Or excuse me, not that much. 90 meters of water or greater.
Matt, can you repeat the question again? Sorry, for the DT.
Yes, Beth Gagusky had asked a question about some of the criterion for the main PUC, Maine Public Utilities Commission, which was basically 10 nautical miles from land or any inhabited island, and in 90 meters of water or more, 300 feet. And so what we're looking for is a 25 megawatt, or what the PUC's RFP was for a 25 megawatt development outside of that 10 mile line and in that 300 meter, feet of water or more. So we do have some information. I mean, we can make projections about that 10 nautical mile buffer. This is an area that is outside the 10 nautical mile limit and within 300 feet of water or more. I'd also like to make the statement that this is just areas that meet those two basic criteria. In no way, shape, or form is this area open or proposed to be closed to any type of activity. Yes.
I think it's important to be always mindful of that, mm-hmm. RFP. Also, however, it's important to be having a sense of what the data is and ensure that because of transmission.
Yes.
You know, so not to completely blank out the rest of the area.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Just wanted to make that point.
Yep. Actually, the vast majority of spatial marine data that we have in Maine, to Karen's point, is a lot more accurate the closer you get to shore. That's where there's a lot more activity in terms of birds. We have a lot more information about substrate because of dredging projects that have happened near shore in ports. Also, there are a lot of dredge spoil dumps near shore. We also have a lot of mapped out areas about munitions dumps and other types of things. So we know a little bit more about the environment once we get closer to shore. And like any other state in the United States, it gets a little more, the activity gets a little more vague, a little more spread out the farther you get from shore. So we'll move on to consumptive uses here. This would be under the subtopic, excuse me for 1 second, my pages are backwards. Fisheries/human uses. And I basically divided this topic into two different categories. There is the consumptive and the non-consumptive human uses. Consumptive would include anything basically ranging from commercial and recreational fisheries. I'll hand this over to Deirdre Gilbert in 1 second. And do you want me to? Okay. All right. We actually have two different types of fisheries data we'd like to cover here. One of them is vessel monitoring system data, and the other one are some human use maps that the Ion Institute in Rockland, Maine has developed. To begin with, we do have some fisheries data regarding the OCS. During the Ocean Energy Demonstration Siting Initiative, we went out and did participatory mapping with several users in our planning areas, which I have on here, but we won't get into that process. It's a separate process. But basically, we went out and asked them what they thought about having a turbine in their backyard and the place where they fished. And they told us, they rated different grid cells on it. What we have here, and let me pull it up, is called vessel monitoring system data. And it's basically an aggregation of data from 2006 to 2010 of managed fisheries. Basically what VMS is, it's a transmitter that is required on ships who fish for managed species in the Gulf of Maine. This excludes lobster, scallops, crab, salmon, whales, and highly migratory species such as tuna. So what this does pick up are a lot of fin fish,
The ground fish complex would include things like cod, haddock, cake, any type of bottom fish essentially is what's included in, I think, 13 ground fish species.
So what we're really talking about here is a lot of mobile gear, obviously scallop and anyway, move on. So this is the dark area here on this map is highly fished areas. You'll kind of notice some of these areas they look kind of odd. There's a large rectangle here. There's a couple of other areas. One here. There's one here. These are either habitat closed areas or they're ground fish closed areas. And the reason you'll still see vessel tracks in there is because not everyone fishes for ground fish on the OCS.
Matt, could you just clarify is it the white area that's the vessel traffic and the blue is the area that's fished? Can you explain that?
Yes, I had another question about clarification regarding the map. So what we're looking at here, we have the dark blue areas of heavy traffic areas. This is a density gradient of vessel traffic. Basically, VMS sends out a signal every few minutes relaying the vessel's position to a receiver. And you'll notice that there's a lot of purple spots near the ports. That's because the ships are required to have their transmitter on at all times. So you'll see the heavy traffic, especially down near Massachusetts Bay. There's some heavy traffic fishing along the lines here of the closed area. This is the western Gulf of Maine habitat closed area. And you'll see a lot of fishing there. But for the most part, I mean, once you get farther out, it gets a little bit lighter, and you begin to see you can start to infer when you throw on our substrate data layer here about what the type of habitat is down there. If there's a lot of fishing going on over a certain type of habitat, then, or it's known that there's a lot of fishing that goes on in a certain type of habitat, you can make an inference about what type of habitat is down there. And that's what a lot of groups have done in the past when they're trying to make an accurate habitat bottom map. As I hope I got across in my opening discussion about this VMS data, it is limited. It doesn't pick up the lobster fishery, which is the largest fishery in Maine. There are a couple of boats that have it in Maine, but by and large, it does not pick up the fishery at all. And that, I think, is a good segue to Deirdre Gilbert covering some human use maps that the Island Institute, which is a nonprofit here in Maine, has developed. Yes.
Matt, before you leave it, does it include the herring fishery?
Yes. Yes, it does.